So thanks to Adobe, I was able to retire early, went off and did my retirement thing in Colorado, tore up my knee. Came back here to Santa Barbara, got involved with Lars, got an office here, and I've been working on developing software for Stellar Evolution since then, for the last 7 or 8 years or so. Mesa is the main thing I've been working on for quite a long time now. We may be able to show you more about it. The basic approach here is to do everything you need for doing 1D stellar evolution is the basic overarching idea. I sort of cut my teeth on doing re-implementation of Peter Edgecliffe's code and learned a lot from that and sort of took that plus insights from any other code I could get my hands on. I went through. So I had a chance to look through Garstek in quite a bit of detail on various other codes. So there are different pieces of things reflected in Mesa. The main thing that I brought to Mesa was the idea of, okay, let's try to really redesign it the way I would like to see a piece of software, a package of modules designed, and let's redesign it to take advantage of where hardware is now as opposed to where it was in the 1970s. So instead of having a system that's really optimized for running on an IBM 360, what about one that's optimized for running on the machines we have today that have multiple cores, that have huge memories? Back in those days, memory was very expensive, and so you designed your program to avoid using any extra byte of memory possible. You're fixing it? Thank you. This is great. Yes, no, that's all, no, breaking it is always a good step towards fixing it.
I optimized the connection.
Away. Oh my
God. Okay, now the question is, oh, look at that! I can point at things. Yay!
It'll turn it off and turn it on again.
Okay. We're going to pretend that you can see this. Yeah, you can sort of see that. So basically, with help from Frank Timmies and Falk Herwig and Aaron Dotter and Pierre Lasoffer, Pierre's code is another one. Pierre also took Beglin code and rewrote it, and I took his code and rewrote that. And of course, Lars very much so. We finally got together, and these guys decided that they would. One of the joys of being retired is that I don't have to write papers. And so I don't. But they decided we really needed to have a paper about Mesa, basically an instrument paper. So they're sort of like with a telescope where you would have a paper that's not new science, but it's describing an instrument that you hope people will use to do new science. So that's what this paper is. That came out, it's actually got a 2011 date, but it was, so it's been out for a little bit of time. Actually, here is the paper, is this thing. That's just talking about the paper. So I'm, you know, this is just breathtakingly exciting reading. You will love going through it. Excuse me?
Nice font.
Gorgeous font. It's amazing how difficult it is to get to capture the aesthetics of a font when you've only got a few pixels to work with. That was the whole challenge of that. I can give a separate talk on that now, I think. I was sworn to secrecy, and I couldn't even talk to other people in Adobe about what I was doing. Jeez. Anyway, so we got that paper out, which is basically a reference about the state of where things were a little over a year ago. I can go through more detail, but I'd rather not. I think you guys have got enough background. I don't want to bore you with stuff, so please ask questions as we go along. But the basic thrust of this was this idea of open source, let everybody be able to download it and use it. Modularity, don't just build this grand unified thing with everything tied together. But, oh, hello, I'm sorry, I didn't say hello to you either. Stellar Evolution codes need to have all sorts of different things. They need opacities, they need equation of state, they need nuclear reaction networks. They need various numerical algorithms, like Henny solver-like kind of things. Rather than having that all tied together like that, we've tried to split them apart so you can use different pieces individually on different projects, and that's looking useful. And as I said before, making things, designing things to work with multi-cores, that is really something you sort of have to think about as you implement, as opposed to go back and try to sprinkle that onto an existing code that doesn't work terribly well. It is, happily able, for some magic, to get through the helium core flash, for example. It can take a one solar mass star, and this is, these are some plots showing, it can crank it through from pre-main sequence all the way to being a white dwarf. Hands off. Just start it and it goes for a couple of hours and finishes. That doesn't mean anything will work like that. You know how this game is played. A few things will work, but you try something that seems just like it, what you were using before, and it will not work. So you try a four solar mass star, and it gets stuck on the AGB because it can't eject the envelope in a planetary nebula and dies. So it's still an art form as opposed to just get what you get anything. Learning how to use MESA is, I'd say it's closer to learning how to play a piano than learning how to send a message with a Twitter or something. There's lots and lots to learn. There are tons of parameters, which is not all my fault. Partly it's the state of the art. And learning how to use those effectively takes a bit of time. I have put together quite an extensive set of examples that can be of help in getting started. I am basically the manual, so don't hesitate, please, especially those of you who are going to be here for a while. This would be, if you're interested in this and you're going to be here for a while, take advantage of that and come to my office and we'll go over the particular problem you're doing. I might be able in an hour to get something running that would take you a year to figure out how to get the thing going, if you were lucky. And I don't mind putting in that hour if that means that then you're able to actually do something. But I don't get paid for this, I'm retired, blah, blah, blah. The fun for me is being able to build a useful tool and have people do fun things with it. So the payoff for me is for you to come and say, hey, I want to do this, and maybe it'll do it, maybe it won't, who knows. But I might be able to help you get to that answer earlier and get launched onto doing things. So as an example of that, I'm not going to go through all the rest of the stuff. It does other stuff. We've done standard solar model, sound speed profiles, and everything like this. You're leaving in 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
Yep.
We're going to talk about your star. This is a typical example of doing astroseismology with MESA. Typical means that of the three that I've done, this is by far the best. it's a start of putting together some tools to let us do some of this kind of stuff. In terms of getting modes, MESA has already built into it the 1997 version of Adapulse. I have now the 2010 version on my machine, and I've hooked up MESA to be able to, at each stellar evolution step, MESA star can call Adapulse and get back mode information. If you want to do that, we need to get Adapulse set up on your machine to do the same kind of thing. And soon there will probably be a similar kind of link to Geier and maybe some other codes as well. But that part is in place and is more or less working. Once you're in material, we need to sit down and do a bit more fine tuning to see if I'm actually getting the parameters set up correctly and things of that sort.
Really?
Yes?
Is it really necessary to implement this precision cuts in the evolution step? What you need is to have the right formats of the
output. Yes, that's true. It's the next. What Jürgen did on his own, what I had also done, was make it so that rather than having to go through the file system, you could make direct procedure calls. Okay. So it's basically what you've described except cutting out the file I/O. So yes, the only interface that you really need is from the stellar evolution side, I create whatever data structure it is, or, the information that you need about the Brunt frequencies and blah, 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 hand it to the oscillation code, which then feeds me back then the information that it's getting. But yeah, no, I don't have... Let me be clear. The reason that I had put that previous version of Adapulse into MESA was simply to have another module because I knew there would be people who would be interested in having that. We may, depending on how you're going to feel about it, we may build into MESA some of the hooks. But yes, we can hook in, we can tie into any other code that has got that kind of a programmable interface to it.
Does the output devolution only binary format or ASCII?
For the... When I'm calling Adapulse currently, I am calling it directly using, it's going in, it's sitting there, I've took the version of Adapulse, changed it, and made a library out of it that I link to at runtime. We can go into more details on this later, but basically it's got all of the controls there that you have for Adapulse, and all it's doing is avoiding going through the file system.
Which is an advantage. I think that's what she's getting at, is that if you do have to go through a file system, there's binary compatibility issues between big endian and little endian systems.
Oh, yes.
So by circumventing that, it saves you a lot of headache.
Yeah, it's a little bit more work up front, but eventually you get there, okay. Okay, so there, I decided to go through a couple of cases out of the literature. I've done HD4938, where is he? He's not here this morning. Yes, he is here, that's right. That guy, that one's, I've got the worst results on that for. We're gonna have to work on that somewhere. It's not their fault, it's my fault. And we did Gamma, because there were a lot of different results there, and Beta Hydra. I take the starting model that the paper says should be there, and then sort of work from that. To try to get a reasonably good fit with Mesa. I have not done extensive model fitting, tuning kind of things. I just wanted to see if we were at least getting in the ballpark. And I've put together for a little how-to example here on this one that says, okay, how am I going to run this? Well, the first step is to create, I'm going to go over and over again through doing the evolution, tweaking a little, some parameters. I don't necessarily want to have to go all the way back to starting at creating a pre-main sequence model for that. I'm guessing that it's okay to start a pre-main sequence model, evolve it down the track a little bit, catch it when it's still fully convective, save that model, and then I'll use that as my starting model for doing the multiple runs of tuning parameters. So that's what first step one here is. The first inlist, an inlist is a text file that has all the parameters for the run for it. First inlist is going to go in, create a pre-main sequence model, evolve it into log L drops down to a certain level, which I know from ahead of time from looking is just early enough that it'll still be fully convective. Then it will save that model away. Then I'll come in with this and change and switch over to this second inlist that will load that model that we've saved previously. It will now switch over the atmosphere boundary conditions to using photosphere tables, because if I try to use photosphere tables way up on the pre-main sequence, it goes blah. So now it's safe, now I can do that. I'm also, in this particular case, turning on element diffusion with just, in this case, three classes. Should say, Mesa's got a lot of options in there to explore different physics. It's got rotation a la Langer, including the dynamo option. It's got thermohaline mixing, semi-convection. It's got Ledoux as well as Schwarzschild. It's got overshooting. Lots of different atmosphere options, the ability to use lots of different opacity tables that you want, very flexible reaction nets. So you can get yourself in all sorts of trouble with looking at what different things do matter, as you imagine. You can imagine you change your surface boundary conditions from photosphere table to, yes?
Do you have also the option of adopting different convection models in it?
Different convection modes, gee, what a silly.
Models.
What we do have, one of the things that I have been concerned about in Mesa would be to make it easy for people, relatively easy for people to do experiments like that without having to get into the internals of the code. So Mesa is structured as a set of modules, but they're packages, you might think of them, And each package has got a public interface, and then it's got a private implementation. In the case of the Stellar Evolution code, there are several things that people really would like to be able to experiment with on their own, winds, mixing, things like that, and there are ways to plug in your own code for some of those. So we should chat about what it is that you want to try and see if that fits into this fairly flexible framework that I already have in place. If it doesn't, I'll make the framework more flexible until it does.
The particular question I have here is whether you can take into account in the integration of hydrostatic support additional to the gas pressure, also the pressure that comes from the Reynolds stresses.
Aha!
That makes a difference.
I'm sure it does. Come talk to me and tell me what I should put in. I have no axe to grind in terms of which physics should be in the code. I want the code to be nice and flexible and pretty, but I don't care about frankly. No, I'm in the sense that it won't offend me if you tell me, you're missing the most important thing here. That would be great. I'd be delighted to add that.
So which Fortisflight tables come with the code?
Several. The standard ones, thank you. You could tell I was stumbling on that one. There's actually here. Oh, that was a great question. Here, we'll go back. See if we can.
You just said one condition during evolution. Then.
Yeah, let's see if we can find it. Ah, there it is. Go back here. Yeah, so there are, oops, too much. It's set up like, the standard one is set up like this, so that it will use the CK when you're in that range and drop down to using cond. Cond is the BRAF, et cetera, one that they have used for brown dwarfs, giant planets. We've also got versions of cond that work at 100, at a tau of 100, which is what they tend to prefer. These can be used at different optical depths. I think I'm using it just it's sort of a standard photospheric optical depth case for this particular example that we're talking about here.
If you would couple that to non-adiabatic computations, would you also perturb the atmosphere?
Same. Good question.
It really depends on when you've got.
You should use the same boundary condition as in the models, right? So.
I've talked to Mike Montgomery. I've talked to Mike Montgomery about this a little bit in the context of white dwarfs. And we have some other atmosphere models from Mike that I'm not talking about here that are relevant for that. But the other question is that we played around with for a while was, okay, what can we do with MESA in terms of moving where the surface of the model is in optical depth? And we actually have a great deal of flexibility in that. So I can actually go into MESA in a white dwarf model or something and move that outer shell of the model out to an optical depth of 10 to the minus 4. And still run things, and so I can give you a model that goes way, way out there. That may not be what you want, though, because if you want non-gray atmospheres, obviously, you don't want to do that, you want to do the other, so.
Do you have built-in?
It's not obviously what's the best answer on this.
Do you have in the Goulds atmosphere a built-in way to extrapolate when you get out of the tables?
That's always a problem. This guy is set up, it says, you can see where it says, up in that corner it says Eddington T tau. So basically, it goes over there and starts switching over to that at the edge.
You don't get convergence problems when you switch?
Of course. It's blended enough. It's blended enough.
So you smooth it.
So yeah.
So you know,
life is hard in this game. I have the same problem with opacities. I have the same problem with equation of state. The opacities are, now let's take a brief look at this. This isn't quite up to date, but it'll give you an idea of the situation. Where is the opacity picture? Where is the opacity picture? This is the same kind of thing that's going on here, where this is really a problem in terms of blending, because we're trying to cover a very wide. MESA is doing everything from planets to 1,000 solar mass, metal-free collapsing with electron, pair collapse supernovas. So you've got this huge range plus crystallizing white dwarfs. So we've got Sasha Patekin's EOS for way down with the crystallizing white dwarf range. We've got Frank Timmy's EOS for up in the range where you really care about things like positrons and electrons, but are willing to assume that everything is fully ionized. We've got Opal for the range where you don't want to assume full ionization, but you've only got limited coverage in terms of density and temperature. We've got SCVH for the situation where you're down very low temperature things. So we have to blend all of those together because stars have this nasty habit of going through different domains. Same thing with opacities. We've got Compton up at the really high part. We've got places where we're electron conduction dominated, other places where we'll be using Opal OP, some places where we'll be using Ferguson. I've now got a new set of tables from Richard Friedman at NASA for covering, they're really useful for irradiated planets because it covers this range sort of right in there where your irradiated planets want to fall. So that's a nice addition for that. But yeah, all of these require blending problems.
But when you put in the diffusion, you have the metallicity that changes in some part of the star. Do you have the possibility to adapt the opacity tables to follow the change of composition? I know it's very, very time consuming.
Talk to that lady next door to you.
It's very computer time consuming.
We haven't put
So you're not planning to put that in, but that would mean inline calculation capacities and
problems. Yeah, right.
So we're planning to do that.
Now. Okay.
Yeah. You know, you don't want to force something like that on everybody, but there are some people who care and are willing to let it run as much slower as it.
Months?
Yeah. Hopefully not. Yeah. Right. Oh, one of the major changes that has happened even since last May is we're making a much better use of multi-cores now. The big hang-up previous to this had been in trying to solve the linear algebra for the stellar evolution code. We're using a band matrix. Anyway, it's scaling much better with the number of cores now. So if you do have access to a 12-core machine, MESA will actually be able to make use of it pretty reasonably, whereas 6 months ago it would have stalled out for MESA star at around 3 or 4. All right. Let's actually run it and see what happens. Okay, let's see. So the first thing it told us was that we should go in here and change the inlets, and that is set to ones already, so I'm okay with that. So the standard sort of dance you end up doing is you'll clean, it says let me get rid of all of the current stuff and remake it. When I'm doing the remake here, I'm just building my local working files, not the entire system. So it only has to recompile a couple of files. I only have to do that when I've changed things or got a new version of the system. Run goes, reads the inlets. That first stuff that went shooting by there was all Adipulse stuff that I haven't figured out how to turn off yet. The code is set up to be, you can optionally have bunches of different windows in action as you're running. We'll go into more detail about what those are doing now, but this guy is doing that. What did we do? Oh, I know what I did. I didn't save that. That's all right. We'll just keep going with this. We jumped to the second one already. Okay, slow down, guys. It's going too fast. I hate it when the program goes so fast you can't keep up with it. Let's stop that. We'll get back to this. Stop. Let's see. What was I saying? We had gotten derailed when we started to talk about the connection to Adipulse. Some of the issues, of course, are going to be how do you decide when to go in and actually evaluate the full set of non-radial modes as well as the radial ones, and how do you go about searching for best models. And a lot of those things are still TBD. I've got something in. I've got a first, we think we might have an implementation of the corrections for surface effects, the kind of magic that gets done for that before chi-squares get calculated. So a lot of it is a work in progress, and what I would really love to see happen would be some of you decide you would be willing to throw yourselves at this problem in the sense of saying to yourself, okay, this looks sufficiently interesting that I'd be willing to spend some time seeing if it is actually ready for doing science. I think it's getting really close. There'll be some things we'll undoubtedly have to fix, but I think it's getting really close. But it needs people like you to go in and actually look at the results that it's giving and compare it to what you know in your guts what's supposed to look like, and finding the differences and helping me to figure out what's going wrong and fix it. Okay, did you get saved? Okay. So that plot you probably recognize. Let's see if we can stop this for a second and explain what some of these different things are. This is the in list for the job that's running right now, and it is set up. Set up to crash if I type the wrong thing. Okay, I've now got it set up to where it is pausing between steps so I get a chance to actually talk about what we're looking at for a second. This blank one is the history, so we don't have any history yet. This window is showing the interior structure in the temperature density profile, cores here, surfaces here, hydrogen burning ZAMS is gonna be up here. We're still fully convective. Information here about where T row, what's happening in the center, abundances here, convection things here. On our propagation diagram, we've got the dotted line is the observed new max value, and the other lines are going to be whatever's happening in the star at that moment. So it's going to evolve for a while. This is starting from the model that we've already saved that has gotten this far, in spite of the fact that I didn't want to do that. I do not have a button push interface because that is more trouble than it's worth at this point. But we can change parameters in this in list for the displays at least as it's running. So I've now told it, don't bother about stopping anymore, just keep going. So now the plots are gonna be updated. We can see that little green section there is where we're starting to build a radiative core. This is the brunt coming up there. This is the little bit of radiative core that happens. Some people don't know that happens in a one solar mass star, but that happens in a one solar mass star. Now it's gone back to being fully radiative at the core. The luminosity is, no, that's, what is that? I have no idea what that is. That is, oh, the boundary. Okay, we're already zooming along. If we look down here, we're coming in, those boxes that you can barely see are the sigma boxes around the target of where we want to match up. This guy, I don't know if you noticed it, but we're now, these two lines are matching up perfectly. That's the model's new max and the new max we're expecting. Down here, this guy is, oh, you're going too fast. Slow down. Okay, one of the things that you can do is stop a run as it's going along. It, as it's going, is periodically saving a sort of an internal snapshot that will let it be able to go back and restart from that location. How often it does that, you, of course, can control. So we're up on model 990 now. Take a hammer and just... Yeah, control C. If you're like Alex Hager, you object to that brute force sort of method. And so for Alex, I added a something that you can change a file name and have it magically stop because it notices that there is a file named stop. But
maybe you can catch control C.
Yeah, right. Oh, one thing I should mention. Speaking of control Cs. We're using OpenMP. OpenMP implementation, certainly in Intel's version and probably in the G4 train version as well, is not always well-behaved concerning control Cs. So this is why I should do it the other way. So occasionally you'll control C it and you'll catch it with its pants down. And it will just not come back. And you have to go in and kill the job by hand. So forewarned. So what you can do in this case, for example, I'll say, okay, let's go back to model 900. Now I could have gone in and edited my inlist file at this point so that I would be restarting, it would reread that, and it could have some different parameters. So I could do change the mixing length at this point if I wanted to, for example. What I wanted to talk about, though, was the idea that this guy over here, I'm not showing all this yet, but it's cranking along here. It has now noticed that it's within the sigma boxes for the surface conditions, and it's starting to check about, now we're going to stop this, and I'm going to look at this. The current, it costs a lot more to analyze the non-radial modes than the radial modes. It doesn't make any sense to go to all the trouble of analyzing those non-radial modes if you are still so far away that you know this is a crap model, don't bother. So there are a couple of different ways that are in the code at the moment for deciding whether it's worth going ahead and paying the price of getting the full mode information. One is doing a chi-square just on the radial modes and seeing if that looks okay. The other is just using the lowest frequency radial mode and seeing if that is close enough to the observed one. So a lot of the time we're spending here, it's coming here and it's giving this message. In this case, I'm doing the difference on that first radial mode. It's saying that the difference is still huge. It's the difference between those radial modes is 22. I've got a threshold of 2. What I'm getting out of the model is 683. What I'm looking for is 660. So it's just quickly just doing the radial mode, saying never mind, and keeping going to the next step on these. And it is also saying we can safely use a time step of a million years in this range, where we're going to have to crank that time step down a lot smaller, 100,000 years, say, when we're getting closer. Because we don't dare take large time steps because things are changing sufficiently fast in there that we will have to avoid that. So we can see it's going along. And then finally down here, you see we're getting to the point where the difference now is 2, our limit is, the difference is 2.1, so we finally have hit our limit on that. Rather than just plunging ahead, the code is so paranoid that it says, okay, let me back up and take a smaller time step and enter this range with a smaller time step more carefully. So now we've switched from time steps of 10 to the 6 down to time steps of 10 to the 5th, and we're going to come back into this range, and now we're getting into the range where we are going to be doing the full chi-squared tests. And here it's starting to say, okay, here I'm getting model model 971, I've got a chi-squared of 11.8. Also, by the way, I've got, what is this other thing? Oh, this is the difference. Okay, that number is the difference in the average delta nu. So the model has got an average delta nu that's about one larger than the observed at this point. And this number is the difference in that first radial mode. So we'll be able to see those things getting closer as we get closer to a good fit to the model. All right, now I'll let it keep going. Don't see much happening in our pretty pictures at this point.
So which algorithm do you use to do the frequency matching? You have just one option of frequency, or you have
no. We've got, she snuck out. We've got about 9 or 10 for beta hydride. Does anybody remember? In that range for each L equals 0, 1, and 2. We do assume, you have to assume that you know what the order is for the radial modes at least. So, and if you get that, you're going to know plus or minus 1 based on the observations.
Okay.
So that's not too egregious of a restriction. So you match up the radial nodes, the radial modes based on n. For the other ones, you cannot rely on the n you're getting back from the oscillation codes. And you just, those, I'm just matching up best fit, best closest guy. So I, for each observed node, I say, okay, which is the closest one out there that doesn't have too hard, we're gonna have to add a filter on that we don't take things that are really high inertia. We only want to get things, but am I getting this totally confused yet, or should I try harder?
No.
Is that sort of answering your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that actually only works for solid time.
Of course.
So
we haven't done any of yours yet.
We have to
absolutely.
Do that for the
absolutely. The whole three cases that I've done so far have all been solar type. okay, so while we were chatting, this guy, this is running with diffusion on, for those of you who think the diffusion has to be slow. It finished, it got down, it got a chi-squared that is embarrassingly too small. And it then chi-squared started getting worse. It kept going for a while because it didn't want to get fooled. And then eventually it said, okay, no, this has gotten so much worse, I'm going to quit now. And then it dumped out some information about what the best model was that it managed to find. So here are the ones that we're matching. You can see the ones we're matching. This is how much is contributing to the chi-squared. That's the frequency the model got. That's after we apply that correction. That's the observed and the sigma on the observed, and that's the inertia that's coming back from the pulse for the thing.
It's the correction we apply to the frequencies.
The correction we apply to the frequencies is the, I'm going to give that to the audience.
It's the Kielsen et al.
Yes. Okay. Which I am happy to bitch and moan about how difficult it is to figure out what that's actually doing based on what's in the literature. But I think that we have eventually implemented something that's more or less that's there. The literature, well, don't get me started. The literature is fine for people who already know what's going on. If you don't already know what's going on and try to figure out how to implement code based on the literature, you are in big trouble.
Have you actually tried it on a solar mode? How have you produced that?
Haven't done that.
How you produce the sun?
Yeah.
We haven't done that. What a good idea. I told you this is my typical model out of the three that I've done so far. Yeah, and I've been doing a lot of other things too. So that's I've got, there's our example for beta hydride. We've got similar kind of thing for gamma where it got more or less a similar model to what is found there. We've got some work to do to try to get the HD guide to work better. And there's lots of interest in doing B stars. I've got an example for Anne of creating one of her favorite B stars, Aida, blah, blah, Airy. No, New Airy. New.
The one I chose finally.
I think you did, yes. Okay. So we've got that, and we've got Hailey's SDBs to work on as well. Am I saying your name right? I hope.
Hi, yeah.
Good. And doing other cases is great. That it's, I think that we can maybe be able to turn this thing into a useful tool for doing what you're wanting. I'm not making any claims that we're there yet, but with your help, we might be able to do that. So I'm very excited about this program going on. It's neat. If you guys don't wear me down over the next few months, ganging up on me and stuff.
Make it the other way.
So thank you.
That's written in Fortran 9 or something?
Yeah, I cut my teeth long time ago, designing languages like C before C existed. So, and I did my work at Adobe in C. So that's sort of the way that I had not even really seen a Fortran program until I started working on these things. Peter Eggleston's code was the first no, actually it might have been yours.
Mine?
From your book.
Oh, okay.
even before I did Peter Eggleston's code, I grabbed...
That was Carl's.
Carl's, okay. Anyway, it is now written in Fortran, but it's not your father's Fortran. it's Fortran that looks more like C than it does like anything else. I'm using the Fortran 95 features very strongly. So things are done using structures and dynamic allocation. And one of my recent changes within the last year or so has been to start to take advantage of the ability to store pointers to procedures as part of data structures, which has been in C for the last 100 years and is now finally starting to make it into the 2003 standard and is now starting to be supported and has finally made it into both GFORTRAN and IFORT. By the way, GFORTRAN and IFORT are the only two that I'm even trying to support, because there is no such thing as a Fortran standard, and every new language is different. Every new compiler is different.
Why are you working in Fortran rather than...
There is a Fortran.
I know there is
a Fortran standard.
There is a Fortran standard, and there is also a Geneva Conventions about how to carry out warfare that is not. The Fortran, unlike the C semantics, are so easy that there really is a standard and people actually do follow it. But Fortran, remember, was... The Fortran standards is intentionally vague, just like diplomatic treaties are intentionally vague, and for very similar reasons.
I respectfully disagree.
Good. I'll get you to try to explain to me some of the features in Fortran sometime.
Okay.
Why am I writing it in? I was very tempted. Part of it was a feeling that I was going to have to deal with Fortran anyway, because exactly. And in fact, there are pieces like that that are around. Part of it was a feeling that I would probably turn off fewer people by going with Fortran than I would with C.
Fewer old farts, yeah.
That's probably true. That's probably true. We don't give a shit about it anyway. I just naively thought the state of the implementations were better. How's that for brutal? The compilers are not as great as I had thought they would be. The language is very nice. There are really some lovely things in Fortran 90 that are much more sophisticated and nicer to use than anything that's in C at this point. It doesn't really matter. Basically it doesn't matter.
A good programmer can write Fortran in any language.
There are some basic things that you need to have. You need to have dynamic allocation. You need to have some of the stuff. So Fortran 77, I would not even have considered. No way. Can't do it.
Did you have to run into any troubles like this edit pulse?
I am not... Basically, no. Because I'm setting very... I would have troubles if I decided, I really need to have a version of that that takes advantage of multi-cores. That would be a big effort. But just calling it and doing it under the assumption that, I'm going... For when I'm calling that, I'm willing to just let it go off and do its thing.
Just like a black box.
Basically.
So that particular program was running now on a single core or on a particular machine?
Mesa, are you asking about it? But
The one we just did
is running on my Mac in that office right there, which is a 12-core machine. And it's using all 12 cores quite effectively. This little guy over here, I tend to put up on my screen, and that shows the, go back. That's showing the processor usage as we go along. So the 12 cores will start to light up in green as it runs, and it's running fairly heavily. Actually, the only reason that I'm not maxing out all 12 cores is because I'm calling Adipulse. And it gets worse here. See, we just go worse? Because I'm now into where I'm evaluating chi-squared, and I'm getting beat up terribly, because almost all of my time now is sitting in Adipulse with a single thread. But if you're running just Mesha, I'll keep all 12 busy, and effectively busy, not just doing stupid things busy, but actually effectively busy.
And do you plan
that in terms of scaling, it runs okay on a 2-core, but the good news is that it now actually is able to take advantage of a 12-core, and when I can buy a 32-core, I think there's a reasonable chance it'll take pretty good.
Well, I have to say it's impressively fast.
Thank you. You can slow it down. It is possible to slow it down.
Do you plan looking at GPU acceleration?
You know, most of our app, there may be some places where that would be possible.
But the relative limitation stuff, when you have to evaluate millions of
GPU is great for an application like ray tracing graphics where you're doing something that's computationally intensive but doesn't need a lot of data. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where we're computationally intensive and we need a ton of data. And we need we need quadruple precision.
What is a ton?
Remember all we were talking about yesterday about all these opacity tables and EOS tables and everything like that. When this thing is running in a job like this, it's using about a gigabyte of real memory.
So. Yeah, if you want to do the relative levitation, that's not a gigabyte.
Ow!
The modern GPUs aimed at the computing market the new NVIDIA line have 3 or 6 gigabytes.
Yeah, okay, no,
and
I'm,
you
yep.
Use, texture memory for fast 2D interpolation.
Great, and they have double precision?
Yes.
Good Lord. Okay, GPUs will be great as long as they turn into complete processors like that.
So it can be a factor of 100.
Yes, I have gotten my fingers burned trying just to use clusters, because each cluster is different, and MPI is, and it's possible to do that, but my focus really has been on what can I do on a single machine using multiple cores at this point. There are some applications. If you want to do an X-ray burst, for example, you need to have a net with 200-300 isotopes in it, and there you start getting into situations where you really do wish you had a way to run it faster. But it may well be that the right solution is to wait for a couple of years and then get a 32-core Mac or something.
But presumably, if one wanted a GPU-accelerated opacity calculator, then that could just be modularized and plugged in.
Yes. But before you start getting carried away at that, you need to spend your time seeing where the code's actually spending its time.
Yeah.
And see if that's going to help anything. It turns out, for example, on the opacities, if I could make the opacities run in zero time instead of what they take now, this would be running maybe 5% faster.
But in Hailey's case, I'm thinking.
That's different. Yeah, that's different. But again, even in Hailey's case, will certainly parallelize beautifully, just with cores.
Yeah.
So.
You use the same interpolation routines for both opacities and creation of state routines.
Yes. I mean, we're using a bicubic spline thing. One of the exercises had to go through this summer. We were doing, in preparation for this conference happening, we were doing some comparisons of MESA to some of the published FGONG files, and discovered that in order to get good matches on the opacities to clay, for example, we had to go in and mimic the opal interpolation routine exactly. Because we were getting, by using a bicubic spline interpolation, even carefully, you'd get 1% errors thrown. So I took the brute force solution on that and went in and used the opal interpolation scheme as a pre-processing step to create tables at double the opal resolution. And then I used my bicubic splines on that, and it's fine.
The problem with bicubic is that you might be prone to unexpected oscillations.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have all sorts of wonderful 1D cubic interpolation schemes that are immune to that problem. And I have not, there's, maybe you can educate me on that. Is there a good 3D? Is there a good cubic, bicubic, that isn't prone to oscillations that splines are?
It's, what's called rational splines.
Yeah, that doesn't help.
But with tension.
Yeah.
There's some.
The other,
actually, you use a like a rubber, you pull on the sides in order to minimize any spurious oscillations between the data points. So I did some tests sometime.
That and overlapping quadratics is the other trick.
That's actually piece one.
Really? Okay.
From computer graphics.
Believe me, I know. Mesa fonts are done using splines, of course. So.
I don't know. People are interpolation. I don't know if you've heard about that, which is quite nice. Where they explicitly try to be monotonic in interpolation.
And this is 2D?
It's already been 2D, yes.
Yeah. Oh, tell me more, please. Not right now, necessarily, but.
Because, as you said, I mean, you get even more than a percent.
Oh, good. Yes, you can get huge.
You end up with different stuff.
Yes.
Just using different interpolation.
Yep, completely. Yeah. No, that's very true.
Thanks, Paul.
Come visit. I'm right there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet.